Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter.
Bow, 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 bow.
Wow, we have paid for some smashing sound effects for our new introduction to the show. So that's Jack, and I'm Ben. Welcome to week, well, not week three, but episode three of season three. Here we
Three,
are.
three.
Feels like a milestone. Back in action, doing the thing.
Action Jackson. That's me.
So,
That's what my uncle used to call me when I was a little. I think he still calls me
really?
that. Yeah. It's an old TV show or movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's got. Is it Samuel L. Jackson or am I thinking of Shaft? I can't remember. I've never actually seen it.
I only know that phrase because they reference it in Tropic Thunder, and he uses it as a pejorative term. It's like Action Jackson or Action Jackson can't cry.
Oh, now I gotta rewatch Tropic Thunder, which I would recommend to anybody who has not seen it yet, by the way.
Unless you have sensitive ears for profanity, and then do
Oh, yeah.
not
Yeah,
watch
don't.
it.
But even then,
They
like, I
just
mean,
keep it coming.
literally from the opening of the first scene to about 45 minutes through, I was just laughing nonstop. Like, my face was smiling the whole time, and my face hurt so bad. That's the only reason why I
Yep.
stopped.
It's not often you see like grown men cry from laughing so hard, but I've definitely seen that with that movie.
Oh, yeah. So good. Adam McKay, man. I think it's an Adam McKay movie. He just did good stuff.
What else has
Anyway,
he done?
he did The Other Guys. In fact, Adam
Okay.
McKay is Dirty Mike. That's
Okay.
him. That's Adam McKay. What else? Talladega Nights, I think. He did a lot of like the really funny movies from like the mid 2000s to 2000 and I don't know, 13, 14-ish.
Okay.
Like a lot of the
Interesting.
top quality comedy movies. A lot of them had Will Ferrell in them. Oh, Step Brothers is
Yeah.
another one.
Okay.
Yippers.
Interesting.
Well, Ben, what's our first topic for today?
Polygamy.
Polygamy. Bow, bow, bow,
Don't know why it's on the
bow.
list. We have a shared doc with ideas for topics to talk about. And this was one that I found on a list that was on my old phone. And usually we put some rationale of like why we wanted to include it or a little bit of context so that we can kickstart the topic. This one had nothing, just polygamy.
Just polygamy out of context.
Yep.
All of a
So,
sudden,
play
bam, polygamy.
your friendly neighborhood polygamist
Yep.
on the roll.
So I got a question, Ben, about
Okay.
polygamy. And this is really like an open question for our readers. Like, do polygamists really expect us to believe that polygamy is about anything other than I just want to have sex with multiple women? Like, is there really any other rationale that we can believe?
I've actually heard second or third hand, I guess, from an answer to that specific question. There's a, well, I think you know who Stan Yoder is, the retired missionary. He and his wife went to Sierra Leone for like a decade and worked with, this was back in, I think, the 80s or 90s, and they were sent to tribes, like rural tribes that were, I guess you could call it a version of Muslim. It was kind of like a folk Islam sort of situation. But anyway, apparently they were or practiced polygamy, and he brought up the issue with them after, you know, obviously they built relationships, and so he was just like, all right, guys, like we've known each other for a while now. Like, what's the real deal with polygamy? Like, is this more than what meets the eye? And their response was that it's actually how they care for basically for widows and what would be, I guess, the I can't even remember the term, like old hens or like spinsters,
Spinsters, yeah,
right?
that's the word.
In their society. And so they were actually, so he was saying, hey, like polygamy. He was arguing the morality of polygamy because it's, I guess, seen as taking advantage of women or not showing the proper respect or whatever. And they were actually arguing the opposite and saying that you Westerners, like, we've been told that you don't provide for your widows and orphans. Like, your government has to do it for you because you're not man enough to, like, marry them and take care of an extra wife. And so they saw it as a stain on our character as a society that there weren't individuals who were willing to care for the otherwise needy in society, and so the government had to do it. So from their perspective, they firmly believe that it's not at all about the physical aspect, that it's about providing for those who don't have means to provide for themselves.
I got a few thoughts floating around. So one of them I want to put out there before I forget, which is I want to circle us back to maybe polygamy in Western culture. Not to say that this is not worth talking about, because it is, because again, I do have a handful of other points. But I guess I was asking the question in the context of, like, if you go to a, I don't know, a commune or something, and they believe in polygamy, it's like, okay, guys, like, brass tacks here. You're just looking to get with multiple women, right? Like, come on, just tell us. They can understand. Like, it's not going to, I get the rationale, but like, don't try to hide it. But anyway, so then the other
So
point,
you're saying polygamy in our context, like in a Western culture.
yeah, like if you were to, like, you move to a new place and you welcome yourself to the neighbors, say, oh, hey, we're the, and then they open the door, say, hey, come on in. You can meet my wife one and wife two, because we're
Sure.
polygamists.
Yeah.
But in the context of this African village, okay, I definitely agree that, the idea of Western culture doesn't take care of the destitute as a being a problem and a stain in our culture. 100% agree. Why, one, do you have to marry the person to take care of them? Why can't you just welcome them as a house guest? So they come live with us, we'll take care of you. And two, okay, marry them so that you can take care of them. That takes care of the women. What about the dudes? There are going to be dudes who need help too. Are you going to marry them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think for the first piece, there is a component of marriage being considered part of someone's value. And I'm not saying this is correct, right? But it's a way of showing someone honor. And so for you to like invite someone in but not care for them, it's like, well, I'm not. Or not marry them. It's like, well, am I not good enough to marry? Or is there something wrong with me? Right? Or if you go back to like super Old Testament commandments for Israel, they were to marry someone to help continue the family name for the deceased person, right? So like the parable of the seven brothers or whatever that died in succession. So there's that component of it. As far as like, what about dudes? I don't know. I think probably in that culture, the assumption is that like men will be able to provide for themselves. But I don't really know.
I would think that there's got to be examples of guys who can't, like if they're handicapped or either physically or mentally, and they can't, do the skills required, that, they would need help. So again, it's like, well, in that case, well, maybe they do take care of them, but they don't marry them because there's some maybe taboo isn't necessarily the right word. It's the closest thing coming to mind, where if a woman isn't married, that does put her in a lower status than if she isn't married, or than if she is married, and whether the quote unquote husband or the caretakers physically or as far as materials go, like food, shelter, just good, being good and neighborly to them, whether in either case, whether this person, this destitute woman is married to the man or not, in both cases, that situation might be identical. But as far as her reputation goes, yeah, if she's not married, she may be otherwise outcast than if she were married. So, did you ever hear, like, are these marriages where they, like, if that's the case, if it is just take care of them, are they saying, well, we marry them, but we don't have sexual relations with them? Or is it, oh, no, we have sex too?
I mean, that was never clarified, but my assumption is that, or I guess my understanding is that they don't have like a different type of marriage for second wife, third wife, fourth wife, right? It's like if you're married, then that comes along with all the implications of being married.
Interesting.
I mean, there's also just the element of, especially in cultures where infant mortality is high, right? And it's just very much focused on survival, that wanting to have many children is a way of improving your status and improving the likelihood that your family heritage will live on, right? And that you'll have people to care for you in your old age.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, as far as let's say a village or a culture, like a whole people, there's going to be roughly the same amount of men and women, or roughly the same amount of men as there are women. So you don't need one guy taking five wives to have more kids for the whole community, right? Whether those five women are getting pregnant by one man or by five men, like individual husband and wife pairs, you're not getting any more kids out of the deal. It's just that the families that those kids belong to, that those kids are concentrated in certain families. Because, if there's a village of 100 people, 50 dudes and 50 chicks, but each dude marries two wives, that's half the dudes aren't having a family.
Right, which I think is, I mean, I guess I would say if you look historically at societies that have had that as a practice, that's led, there's been two things that were either influenced by that or a result of that. I guess I just said the same thing, either influenced that or were a result of that. So the one is that because you'd end up with large numbers of men who didn't have wives. That kind of led to typically there'd be a lot of raids between villages, right? Where you would carry off women and or children to then be wives for the dudes that didn't have them. Then the flip side, because they're raiding,
Yeah, this yep, this is what I was thinking of.
there are a lot of men who then die in the raids, and so there are fewer men that need wives to begin
Right,
with.
right. So probably in these populations that, where there was a lot of warfare, there probably was disproportionately more women than there were men. And then you couple that with the status thing again, right? These women who, if they're not married, they're in a lower status, then that's ripe ground for polygamy.
But I think if we circle back to what you're saying of like polygamy in our culture,
Right. Those aren't factors in modern Western culture.
yeah, and I was gonna say like most of the instances that I've ever heard of, it is practice in a very exclusive, like secluded group, right? And there's typically a very persuasive, what's the word I'm looking for? Charismatic leader of some kind, right? And usually,
Talking about a cult.
not always, but usually there's some kind of messiah complex going on, right? And it's like, hey, I got this special club that you can join, but only if I can have your wife and daughters and whatever else, and nobody else can, right? It's like,
This just sounds like you're describing a cult with extra steps.
oh, I mean, I'm basically describing a cult, but I feel like in those instances, it's pretty transparently not about caring for the women and children. It's like a power trip for the leader of the cult that they're the only one who can have sex with anybody. And they get more of it, right?
Right. So in that context, and not necessarily even in the context of a cult, like I think there's just one-off polygamy or polygamous relationships where they're not part of a cult. And it may be even an organizational practice, but it's not necessarily a cult. It could just be how they do things. Like what is the rationale beyond just, dude, I just want multiple chicks, because what guy doesn't want that, right? Like what are they, why can't they just come out and say that? Is there actual legitimate reasons why they think they're doing it? And maybe I'm being too arrogant about it, but I don't see there being any real practical reasons that they could justify doing it beyond that reason.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we're seeing as a society is that more and more people are willing to say things like that, right? Like the term thruple is getting more and more publicity, right? Of whether it's multiple wives or, a love triangle of some kind, but where it's like a group marriage of some kind or a group relationship, I guess, if you want to call it that. And that's not the only form, right? Like, I mean, polygamy historically has been defined as, one husband with multiple wives that are officially married. But I feel like there are more and more people who are willing to live in a situation that's effectively that, but it might have different names, right? It might be, I guess there's not the commitment component necessarily. There's probably a whole spectrum or array of those types of relationships, but people who are in open relationships or people who just are essentially I guess that doesn't really fit, never mind. I was going to say people who are just married serially, like married divorce 8 times or whatever. But so I think there is a lot more, there are a lot more people who are willing to just say whatever. They're pursuing their heart's desire in whatever form that takes in a relationship.
I think it's the heart that's making the decisions there.
I mean, I'm using that as a loose term because for some people it is more emotional, right? Not saying that's always true, but it could be.
How come
But
we
yeah,
never see?
I think there's a part of it where it's like they can't choose. Right? It's not that they're necessarily like, or they don't feel like they have to choose, right? They just don't understand, they don't have, there's no personal ethic that says marriage is between two people. And so they're just like, well, why should I choose? If both of these people are willing to be married to me, why wouldn't I? Right? I think
Sure.
that's a core driver of how it happens.
I don't think I've ever seen, though. To be honest, I don't really know all that many polygamists, nor have I seen a whole lot of interviews with them. But to me, it seems like whenever polygamy comes up, it seems to be portrayed as this is these people's earnest belief in how marriage should be, or they see some intrinsic value in it. Beyond just, no, they just want to, they just want to get with a bunch of women. Like, it seems like there's some, again, like some sort of belief system where it's like, this is right for us, this is what's best for us, rather than, in my how I see it, is rather than just admitting, say, I just want to have more sex.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a natural human tendency, right? To we don't tend to do a lot of things that we think are evil, right? We may do things that we don't think are necessarily good, but if we do something, we tend to have a rationalization for why we do it and that it's okay to do. So I don't think there's a lot of people out there like, oh man, I'm gonna marry this person and have a bunch of sex, but I shouldn't be doing this, right? They think it's good and beneficial and
Or they
whatever their
try to
reasoning is.
convince themselves that it is.
Right.
Yeah, that it's okay. And it could be even that maybe they're trying to counteract some, well, you know, the way I was growing up made me feel guilty about it, even though I rationally think I shouldn't be. So I'm going to go through with it anyway, against my instincts, because I believe my instincts are wrong, or subconscious maybe. I've been more or less brainwashed by a society that believes in monogamy arbitrarily. And although I may initially feel bad, I'm going to fight against that because that's just the brainwashing talking. I can maybe see that. But then why don't they come out and say that?
Well, I would say there are a lot of people who are saying that now, and not even that they necessarily practice polygamy, but I think, like I was saying, some of these other more amorphous relationship types are people who have said, hey, I think monogamy is a construct that isn't necessarily good or bad, and it doesn't work for me, or I want to explore other things, so why shouldn't I?
They come out and say it, and then, hey, I get it. Okay, it's like, all right, I understand the rationale. I don't agree with
I
it,
mean, it's
but at least they're being upfront about it.
like if you just strip it down to, I don't know, I'm sure you could turn to it like sociologist or psychiatrist who would have more reasoned arguments for or against. But I would say just logically, like if you don't have a framework for why marriage should be just one, two partners in the relationship, then why would it be bad, right? Because presumably they're all adults, they're all consenting, they've all said, yeah, I want to be a part of this thing. So there aren't really a whole lot of good reasons to say it's wrong unless you have some sort of a religious, moral objection, right? Because you believe that it's not the way that marriage is defined.
I would believe that there's secular, psychological or sociological arguments for monogamous relationships. I don't know of any. I'm sure that there's stuff out there. Granted, I'm also sure that there are similar studies done for polygamous relationships that say that's also more beneficial than the other choice. So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and I think there's also, I mean, as soon as you get a population large enough, you're going to have, it's like if you're maybe 99.98% of the population are like find monogamous relationships to be great and rewarding and fulfilling, speaking from a purely secular perspective, but it's still, you still have variability in that, right? And so you're bound to have people who don't find it fulfilling and who, are seeking fulfillment in other types of relationships.
Yeah.
I think the part that's the question that I would have is like, if you're truly not satisfied with one partner, is adding a second one enough? Or like, do you just, if you've got two wives or two husbands or whatever, do you just always want to keep adding more or does it, because
Where,
it
yeah, where
feels
does it
like
end? When
towards
is it
the
enough,
end.
right? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, but maybe that, maybe that's offensive to people who are in those relationships who are like, yeah, I just really like these two people and want them in my life forever. And so here's, there would never be more than three. I don't know. Probably varies by person.
How come we don't see too many polygamous relationships where it's like one chick and two dudes? You know, it always seems to be one husband with numerous wives. Why never the other way around?
I mean, I think you could argue that historically women haven't had the position or status to make that work.
So, okay, hold on.
And there weren't, like, men weren't willing to share.
So then, why are the women willing to share?
I mean, if you build on that logic, maybe you could say that they were more or have been more willing to share because something is better than nothing. And so if you're not in a powerful enough position to, well, especially w if women didn't have resources, right? They didn't, they, that's always been one of the arguments for the power against the power dynamic in relationships between men and women in society is that men have the income and the political power and all different forms of power accumulated, and a woman doesn't have any means to accumulate that for herself. How can she say no to sharing, right? If a dude decides he's going to go off and get another wife, it's like, well, I can't go get another husband. Or even if I do, then I might be in the same situation. So it's like you kind of got to take what you get. And you could say that it's not true anymore necessarily, or not in all situations, but again, it could be a conditioning thing over time where that's just what is kind of ingrained.
It seems to me, though, right, this pattern of polygamous relationships much more often being one dude with numerous women, as opposed to one woman with numerous dudes. The fact that the former is historically, and I guess it's just an assumption. I haven't done any research, but still the norm today. That kind of indicates to me that it isn't about this emotional, or relational, preference, where say I feel more fulfilled with two partners rather than one, because unless that psychological, well, no, not even I was going to say even if that psychological tick is more present in men than women, well, the men may be okay with more partners than one, but the women don't necessarily have to be okay with sharing. You know what I mean? Like it's like if it is disproportionate, that guy say, "Hey, I'm open for two wives. Like, let's do this." But the two women he's approaching, are say, "No, I want monogamy. I don't want to share you with another woman." So to me, it seems like it seems like the power play is a way to bribe them, to say, "Hey, I'll give you this stuff, but you have to be okay with me having this other chick." And it's like, why would they need to say that? Oh, because it isn't actually all that fulfilling. They, as the dude, just want more chicks in their harem, as it were.
Yeah, as you were talking, I realized that the simplest and most plausible explanation has been completely unexplored at this point, which I think someone who studies biology would have rapidly pointed out, which is that for a woman, it doesn't matter how many men she's with, from a genetic and reproductive perspective, she can only have one child every 10 months or whatever, right? A man can have as many children as wives he has in a 10-month span. So there's no reproductive benefit for a woman to have multiple husbands, but there is reproductive benefit for a man to have multiple wives.
If family size and maintaining your lineage is important, but that's not important today. In fact, we're having a lot fewer kids than we have been historically.
No, but I think they would. So, like, if you look at, like a pride of lions, for example, right? There's one male lion and like six female lions that he would reproduce
Do
with.
the hibbity-dibbity with.
Yeah, hibbity bibbity. But anyway, so it's that same concept applied, right? So the argument being is we essentially haven't escaped that survival instinct. And that would be why men have more of a drive to have multiple partners than women.
And then
Is that
also
our physiology hasn't caught up with our modern environment.
And I was going to say, and also might explain why women may be okay with having multiple, have to share their like the dude with multiple other women, whereas a dude wouldn't be okay with sharing his women with another guy.
Right.
Because both those, the women being okay with it and the dudes not being okay with it, complement each other
Right.
for that drive. Very intriguing. This has been a much more nuanced conversation than I was expecting.
Yeah, it's gone a lot of different directions.
This is just two dudes who've done no research on the topic, speculating. on it. You actually provided some what I would call research. The that Yoder missionary dude having spoken to the
Yeah.
people in Africa. That's good background.
It's kind of interesting as you say that. There were two things that came to mind. One of them was the concept of Occam's razor, which I assume you're familiar with.
Is that the simplest answer is most often the correct one?
Yes. Yeah. I was thinking of that in terms of like, it had some kind of roundabout, like maybe kind of, oh, that could be right descriptions. And then the biology one was like, no, that's the simplest, most explanatory answer.
Yeah.
But then the other piece was I read a book last year, I think. Dang, what was the title? I think it, yeah, it's called Spirit of the Rainforest. And it's written by someone who sat down with a shaman from the Amazon and basically wrote down an oral history of their tribe, and this shaman's experience. And it's from, I don't know, it was written in the, it was published in the 90s. But the events happened in like the 60s, 70s, 80s. Anyway, I thought it was really interesting because the at the end of the book, the shaman or someone from his tribe like goes to the US, or yeah, I think it was the US, on like this book tour. And it was fascinating because this tribe had there were Christian missionaries there, but there were also like secular anthropologists there studying their behavior. And then I can't remember, there was some other group, I think just like business interests in the area. And it was kind of fascinating hearing how the shaman reacted to the different groups' perspectives of their tribe and their behaviors, right? Because it was, they're very different and conflicting. And like the behaviors of the missionaries were very different than the behaviors of the anthropologists. And there were things that the tribe liked and didn't like about both groups, and some of the stuff that they were doing. But anyway, that came to mind because they were, those tribes practiced polygamy for similar reasons that I described, that Stan had, tribes Stan had been with in Africa. But anyway, it was kind of interesting to actually get that feedback of like they heard missionaries and anthropologists describe their traditions and habits and culture, and then they got to respond to it. And you don't often get that full circle feedback. It's pretty interesting to read. So, anyways.
Said caught my ear, which is you said that they practiced polygamy for similar reasons as did the village in Africa, even though they're separated by a whole ocean and haven't, their ancestors probably haven't been in contact for thousands of years. So there's some either common practice that's been preserved this whole time, which is possible. It's also possible that they just developed that behavior separately and they came to the same conclusion. That to me hints at like some underlying psychological, foundations in the human, I guess, psychology. Why is it that women, their status is dependent on them being married? Because that developed in these two independent cultures. And I think even, I've read stuff from like ancient China, ancient, I guess, is maybe not the right word. It was in the early 80s where it's similar. A similar story. So how have all these despondent cultures all reached the same conclusion, independent of one another? And, you know, likely not intentionally. You know, they haven't. It's just the way things developed. What does that say about the human psyche?
Just to clarify, did you mean disparate cultures, not despondent?
Yes, disparate, sorry.
Okay, just wanted to check. I mean, they could be really sad, too. That's an unknown at this point. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be one of the fascinating components of studying human behavior across cultures, right? Would be seeing the different ways that there are deep similarities from groups that have been completely disconnected for generations.
And they don't know that these other cultures are doing the, you know, they're not like, hey, we got notification from Africa. They're doing polygamy now. We have to catch up, you know.
Right, right. There's no forest Twitter or something like that.
Yeah, and actually, I think like, you know, if an anthropologist does want to study, or maybe not anthropologist, but whoever does study the human psyche, you know, what you just said is a great way to figure out a lot of the deeper stuff going on in the human brain, which is you get these groups, you separate them for generations, and you let them develop independently. What similarities come out of that? You know, these two groups that are not coordinating, what conclusions do both of them reach for, you know, independently of one another? And I think there's some aspects that they will, just out of practicality, when it comes to maybe hunting or building shelter or health related stuff, things that have practical advantageous versus non-advantageous effects. And they'll just, through trial and error, come to the same conclusions, because there's only so many different directions you can go. There's only, you know, there's really only a few different ways to hunt effectively or to cook food effectively so that you can mitigate getting foodborne illness. There's only so many ways to build a shelter. And a lot of these things, there's one best way. And so over time, they're going to just inadvertently discover it by happenstance or trial and error. And then once they find it, they stick to it. And there's going to be nuances with what animals there are to hunt, what materials are there to build with. But when it comes to, like, the whole woman's status is based on, or heavily dependent on, if she's married or not, that doesn't, to me, seem to have any real, like, how does that come out of just, you know, living? You know, you get a bunch of humans together in a biodome, right? And you say, okay, just start living life over, and, you know, they can have kids, and over the generations, that behavior would probably pop up again, even though there's real no practical advantage to doing that, as opposed to if they held women who weren't married in high esteem. At least I can't think of any reason why. So why does that keep, why does it keep coming up? That's my question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also raises an interesting question of if humanity started without any guardrails and you're just out in the wild doing whatever you want and making it up as you go, like, what would have caused a society or many societies to consolidate their social structures around the idea that there should be, like, marriage should be monogamous, right? Or that they became very patriarchal in many instances, right? Like, how did all those things come about organically if there weren't any constraints on it, right? It seems like you would, if there weren't benefits for society and for humanity, you'd have a lot more diversity of practices, right?
Right.
And we certainly talked about some of the diversity of those practices, but those are very marginal, right? In most societies, there's one very dominant practice, and the rest of them are almost non-existent.
Are you're talking about polygamy?
I mean, polygamy or open relationships or any other version of reproductive relationship, right, would be It seems like there'd be a lot more diversity if there, if we truly didn't have some sort of instinctive preference for monogamy or for polygamy, right?
Right, because if there's no one obviously best way of doing something, you're going to get variety for because there's going to be other things influencing that decision.
Right.
But if there is one obvious best way of setting up a fire or building an encampment, then there's only going to be so much variety because as soon as that society finds that way of doing it, they're going to realize that it's the best way and they're going to stick to it. And over time, the different societies are going to, again, trial and error, happenstance, stumble across the same thing, and then they're going to keep doing it. So when there's an obvious best way of doing something, it makes sense that we would see consistency. Again, there's going to be nuances based on the individual factors that play in the given locations.
Right.
But it's those situations where, okay, there isn't a quote unquote best way of doing this thing, but all of the cultures seem to gravitate towards one way of doing it. Like again, the women's status of not being married. Why is that better than if we held them in high esteem or we just didn't care? And I'm not saying we could talk in circles because we don't have the answer, but that's what's bugging me in my brain. And is it just an instinctual thing where the whole society tends towards that? Or maybe it's related to, men are naturally and have historically been have demonstrated, that's the word, to be more aggressive, more assertive, and just physically stronger. So even if the women don't want to be polygamous or don't want multiple men, or if they even do want multiple men, but the men also want multiple women, and something's got to give just based on the numbers. The men may just win out over time because they're just stronger and more assertive, and that it might be just a what's the word? A outcome of that. Just men, if it does just come down to men just want more women to sleep with, then they will over time just their dominance will take over, and then that'll just be the practice, and they will naturally come up with that whatever excuses they have to legitimize that. And maybe those excuses get worked into the culture. Maybe that's why women are considered like, or at least in these other cultures are it's shameful for a woman not to be married. And not because that has any real practical consequences, but just because the men want the women, so they shame the women who aren't getting married to encourage women to marry them.
I mean, we still kind of have that. It's not that deep, but there is still,
At least an expectation.
I think on average, many people do get married, and so it's kind of like as you get older without being married, you start to question your own if there's something wrong with you or if you know what I mean? Like it's all just a that hasn't completely died out in our culture. But what I want to go back to is I think it's interesting because it seems like a lot of the more I would say primitive cultures
Wow.
not saying it in a derogatory way, I'm just saying it in
Aren't you though?
that
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
I'm not making a judgment assessment. I'm just saying it's simpler in terms of the way that they operate in some ways. But so if you look at these cultures that we talked about that practice polygamy out in very rural areas of the subtropics, and then if you look historically like at the patriarchs of Judaism, for example, right, tended to practice polygamy or at least not frown upon it. And so the question that comes to my mind is like, why would they invent a religion that says that's not a good idea, right? If they're already like, they can have as many wives as they want, they can have all the sex they want, all the kids they want, blah, blah, blah. Like, what's the practical value for them of coming up with a system of rules that says, oh, you shouldn't do that, that's bad? Or was it invented by some spiteful dude that couldn't get married, right? And then he somehow, even if he invented it, how would he persuade other people to buy into it and to enforce it? Like, how do you go from that in a context that seems like it'd be very beneficial for those who, or desirable for those who are in that situation to just continue propagating it? Why would they completely change the rules? Right? It's like no matter what game you're playing, those who are winning it don't want a rule change that benefits those who are losing, right? Like that's the way we see it in our society with billionaires and big businesses, right? We don't want rule changes that help other people get more power in society. So why would people who are at the top of the pyramid embrace a rule change that completely negates their influence and authority? Even if it's over a long period of time, it just doesn't seem like it would be a natural progression.
It's almost as if there are supernatural powers at play, Ben.
Wow, that's a wild, wild conclusion.
Picking up your sarcasm.
Oh, the other thing I was going to say is, have I ever told you about my idea for this is not specifically related to polygamy, but using the United States for designed experiments.
Go on.
So I've always thought about this. We've got 50 states, right? And they're all very different, but we could do trials on like what is the right approach here, right? So we could randomly assign rules or laws to different states, be like, okay, these 10 states are going to have I don't know. Let's take the law that New York City had for banning like oversized soft drinks or whatever. So we could be like these 10 states are going to completely ban soft drink, or let's start this way. These 10 states are going to do nothing different. They're just going to have whatever laws they have in the books today. No changes. These 10 states are going to completely ban soft drinks. These 10 states are going to
Subsidize soft drinks.
subsidize soft drinks. These 10 states are going to have like wellness programs and coaching and stuff like that, right? And so you could lay out a whole design of experiments with laws that I guess in my opinion wouldn't be unethical, that would help us determine what is the right approach to solve some of these problems that are facing our society today. So in that example, New York City was trying to tackle obesity. And so it's like, okay, let's prove it out. Let's see if restricting access to large size soft drinks has any impact whatsoever on the rate of obesity in our culture, right? And you could evaluate different things and attempt different solutions. And there's a large enough, I think if you did randomized trials by state, there's a large enough sample size that you could actually have some reasonable results to interpret.
I'm glad you brought that up because I've had a similar thought before. And why aren't states, well, because if you wanted to actually like have the federal government say you states are partaking this experiment whether you like it or not, like that wouldn't work out so hot. That's why we
No, I mean
delved into states in the first place. But I
it
agree,
would
like
start out as like a it would be, hey, this is an idea that we're trying to get buy-in for, right? And so presumably all the like Congress would vote to say, yeah, we want to launch this program. And then there'd be some bounds on it. So it couldn't be like, well, we're gonna say that nobody in this state can ever get married again, or nobody, you know what I mean? Like it'd have to be things that are reasonable. But yeah, anyway, continue on.
well, I was going to say, like, why don't states get a little bit more ambitious with the laws that they pass? And sometimes they do. And in fact, it's, you know what? See, I think the thing is, a lot of the times they do try to get ambitious. It's just that, they have to watch out for their own population that they have to keep happy. So if they're like, I think that's why they don't get ambitious is because, we're all people, we're all human beings, we're all Americans. There's not a lot of identity to your specific state, as much as there was 150 years ago. So it's hard for these states to pass very unifying laws because the people in New York don't want it, and the people in Wyoming probably aren't going to want it either because there's not a lot of difference between New Yorkans and Wyomans, or I don't know if that's the right denonym, but I mean, sure, there are definitely differences, but not as much as there used to be, and not as much as there is, say, between a German and an Italian. So there's a lot of homogeneity, there we are, going on in the U.S. Not 100%, but, you know, Americans are Americans, I would say, first, then they belong to their state, for the in my experience. That's my experience. I'm not saying that.
Speak for yourself, Minnesotan.
Yeah, that's my experience. So, for example, if Minnesota wanted to get really ambitious with some law, and they were going to try this out, you know, there'd be a lot of backlash because it's just sort of, I don't know, like a bunch of milquetoast all around.
I kind of disagree with that, because I feel like if you look at the current political state of affairs in our country right now, you have like the three states on the West Coast, right, have become bastions of progressive policies, and they have passed very, from my perspective, significant laws, whether at the state level or at the local level, but a lot of stuff at the state level, that are significantly more progressive than the middle of the country. And now you're seeing, like, California is having this mass exodus of people who are moving to Texas because they're tired of all the laws and stuff like that. So I guess I would agree that there's pushback, but where I would disagree is that in some cases there already has been a stratification of politics by state, and that, you know, you're getting states that are, you know, have a more blue voting base that have become more blue in policy as a state when compared with the average of the nation. And the same with red states too. So the problem that I have with that is, it's not a problem. It's a study type of problem, is that when you have people who are like-minded making rules that they prefer for themselves, you've got so many conflating factors, you can never separate them all out. So for this approach to be able to work at all, you'd have to have a mixture of rules, right? They couldn't all be conservative or all be liberal in a state, or you'd never be able to tell which ones are having an effect, right? So you'd have to have this blend of, like, you know, there's conservative states that have gun control laws and liberal states that have abortion bans or whatever it might be, right? Like, pick your topic. But you would have to, you'd have to have everybody kind of in agreement that they're going to accept some rules they don't like, so that it's more randomized and it's not just based on the type of people who live there.
I see your point. Also, I have to go to a little podcaster's room, so can you just sort of monologue for the next minute or so?
Well, I guess I'm going to. Oh man, what do I want to monologue about? Well, Jack is in the little podcaster's room. I think I'm going to share the fact that Jack likes to refer to the laboratory, the water closet, whatever you call that room. He takes a persona of whatever happens to be the predominant group in the space where he is, and then names it the little blank room. So at work, it's the little engineer's room. Here, it's the little podcaster's room, apparently. Yeah, so, you know, it could be a little cowboy's room or a little whatever's room. But we have had conversations in the past about, it's kind of weird how that phrase even got started, the little boy's room or the little whoever, little girl's room, whatever. Like, why did that come to be? How did that cross someone's mind that that's what it should be called? Because it just kind of seems odd that that's how people would refer to the restroom. I mean, it's kind of like the unwritten rule. You're not supposed to talk about it, right? And so we come up with other little euphemisms to dress it up and make it seem less repugnant, what has to happen in a restroom. But still, just referring to it as little boy's room, little girl's room, little anything room is, I don't know, I'd be curious to know the origin story there of how that came to be.
I'm back. I've been back, but I wanted to hear you keep going. Actually, you know what? That, you raise a good point. You know, we're not supposed to talk about bathroom. Why not? Everybody does it. It's numerous times a day. Why is it such taboo? I can understand if they say, oh, it's gross, you don't want to talk about it. But it's like, why is it so, like, if you tell somebody, oh, I got to go to the bathroom, it's sometimes they can kind of give you a look as if, can you just say I'm going to the restroom? It's like, dude, like, we all, everybody poops. Like, everybody learns that when we're like a little kid. It's one of the best kids' books out there.
Maybe it's taboo. No, I mean, there's a, I think there's some of it is certainly a social stigma, right? But I think there is some inherent ickiness, I guess, or aversion to talking about it just at an individual level. I don't know. What comes to mind is like nobody wants to think about the fact that their parents have sex, right? That's an aversion that pretty much everybody has.
Yeah.
But it's like,
I've also
so the argument
why that is, why is that so, or why is it so weird when you think about, you know, people, some certain people that, you know, like parents or maybe siblings, I guess, I'm an only kid, I don't really know, of having sex. Why is that so, make, why does it make you cringe so much? And I don't know, because it really shouldn't. But anyway, keep going.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I think to your point of like, everybody does it, so that's okay to talk about. I think, I don't know, I feel like there are instances where that's not necessarily true. Or we don't intuitively feel are true. But so the, I mean, you said siblings, the thought that came to mind when you said that is the somewhat awkward relationship, at least from my perspective, that people who are twins would find themselves in, right, when they get married or whatever, end up with a partner in some fashion. Because it's like, well, we're twins. So, like, if you find me attractive enough that you wanted to marry me or be with me in some fashion, then obviously, like, you pretty much have to feel the same way about my twin also, right?
Physically,
that's
as far as physical attraction, yeah.
Yeah, that's my assessment as someone who's never been in that situation. But anyway, I just
naturally,
always
we're the best people to talk about it.
I've always just felt like that'd be like, how do you, that'd be a weird thing to navigate, right? Like, I feel like you just have to acknowledge that and move on, that like it's a thing. I don't know. No thoughts from your end?
Well, I've started cooking dinner, so I have to, like, and I'm, like, doing the stir-fry thing that I mentioned before we started recording, so I have to, mute my mic while I'm over there stirring stuff up. I mean, for the twin conversation, I think there's enough. Can you hear this stuff sizzling in the background when I talk?
There's a light sizzling, but I don't think it's problematic. It just adds a little sizzle to the podcast, you know?
Nah, it's white noise. People
a little
like
something
noise.
Extra.
Oh yeah, for the twins thing, I mean, there's enough other stuff going on besides physical attraction where, yeah, I know you look like my significant other, but you don't also have the memories with me. We don't, we don't have these stories together. They're, you know, I don't know you as well as my significant other. So there's those factors too. I don't think it would, I am in your shoes. I'm in your shoes in that I haven't been in those shoes before. So I could say all this.
We are
now.
Both outside the shoes.
Yes. We are shoeless. Which means that we probably took our shoes off to hand them to somebody, because that was for some reason a way to cement a deal back in the olden days. No idea why. I can't imagine shoes are that cheap. And if they're fitted to you, why would somebody else want your shoe? You know what I mean?
Can't say that I do, but I'm not in the olden days anymore, so.
Oh,
here we
like,
find ourselves.
Like in the, I mean, like the Bible has the account of, like, if you make a deal with someone, you're supposed to hand them, like, your left shoe or something. Or is it like if they reject your deal or something, or they don't hold up to their end of the bargain, you have to give them your shoe, or they have to give you their shoe or something? I don't know. Something weird with shoes, and I don't understand it.
I was thinking about there's something about not taking someone's cloak and pledge or whatever. Or if they do give it to you, then you're supposed to give it back at night.
How can you
so they can keep themselves warm?
How can you take their cloak? Your hands are full of their shoes.
I don't know. It's a good question. But I don't know. I always took that to mean that if you're missing something that you normally need, it's a really good reminder that you've promised somebody else something, right? It's like somebody taking a pen and writing something on their hand or their arm or whatever, a note to themselves to remember for later. Like, well, why don't I have a shoe on? Huh. Can't imagine why. Oh, yeah. I promised Jack that I was going to do that one thing, right? Guess that's a good reason that I took off my shoe. Otherwise, I would have forgotten. But I don't think that ties to the... I don't think that ties into the, like, walk another mile in somebody's shoes thing.
No, that just means put yourself in their situation and have, and you know, guard and gain some empathy for them. I always used to get empathy and sympathy mixed up. Like, I thought they meant one meant the other and vice versa. For, like, the last few years, and only recently did it really click on me after I saw a definition somewhere. I was like, oh, crap, I've been using these in the reverse order.
I guess my definition would be that, like, sympathy is you feel badly for someone or feel sorry for someone, and empathy is you can feel how they feel in the situation, and maybe those overlap in some instances, but not always.
Yeah, and one, the definitions that you gave, yes, are the, you know, what I recently relearned, or I should say properly learned. And yeah, if you have empathy for someone, you sort of inherently also have sympathy for them, or at least I don't understand. Oh, maybe not. Maybe if someone's going through something and they feel bad, you can empathize with their situation, but you may think that they're overreacting or they're weak or something, or say, I empathize with you. I've been in your shoes and I can tell you the way you're acting is not right. In which case they also may not have sympathy for you, even though they have empathy. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe empathy sort of necessitates that you feel sorry for them because you know what they're going through. But just because you know what they're going through doesn't mean that you have to feel sorry for them. Because you can be like, you know, I was through your shoes and I got through fine. You know, buck up.
Yeah, and I think there's also, we were talking about agency earlier, and I feel like there's a sense in which empathy recognizes the other person's agency more than sympathy does. Sympathy is kind of like, oh, that's too bad. Sucks to be you sort of thing. Whereas empathy, I think, tends to be more, at least in my mind, to feel like the person who's being empathized with, there's still a belief that they can do something about it, or that they can influence the situation for the better. So it's not just a resigned, defeatist mindset.
Interesting.
But you are cooking dinner, and I think we have come to a natural stopping point in the topic. So I've moved to adjourn until our next episode.
All right. What was the backup topic we had?
Backup topics were job security for coming up with weird flavors.
Oh, that's right.
And then figures of speech.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Okay.
I think those will be fun, and I think those will be pretty light and go pretty quickly. So looking forward to that.
I don't know, man. I can rail pretty hard against all the different flavors all those food companies are coming out with and the whole, like, why are they doing it thing. But save for another time.
Yeah.
Polygamy carried us pretty much this whole episode, which is very surprising to me.
Considering I thought it was going to die out in about 2 minutes, I would agree. But I did just mean for the other topics that there's kind of an order of magnitude difference in the gravity of a conversation about polygamy versus a conversation about food flavors, in my mind.
I don't know, man. Again, I'm going to be going off.
I'm throwing down the gauntlet here, so bring the thunder. So with that, we're signing off, and hope you enjoyed listening to this dialogue about polygamy, and we will catch you on our next episode. Wishing you the best.
Out, y'all.